This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk, and we have a special guest today. He's one of my more favorite authors. His name is Michael Rebotham, and his new book is called The Secrets She Keeps, and it was just out last month from Scribner here in the United States. Hello!
Hi, how are you?
What confuses me about publishing is that your books in different countries are published by different publishers. So you have like three or four different publishers, right?
Yeah, I do. That was because a lot of writers, when they first sell their book, they sell international rights to one publisher in one country, and that publisher then goes on and sells that book around the world to, normally it's got, if it's a big international publisher, it has, you know, like Penguin or Random House or whatever, it has sort of offices in every country. In my case, when my first novel was sold, The Suspect, in 2002, it was at a bidding war at the London Book Fair, and it meant that publishers from all around the world were trying to get it, and that was a stage where I finished up with lots of different publishers in different countries.
Right. Now you're in Australia now, so who's your publisher in Australia?
My publisher in Australia is Hachette Australia. Which is part of the Hachette Group, which is I think the second biggest publishing or third biggest publishing house in the world now. It's a French Hachette Livre, but it owns, you know, a whole lot of imprints like Little Brown and Hodder and
Mulholland
and those. Mulholland, absolutely, yeah. And I was with Hachette in America, actually, up until this book. For quite a number of books, I was with Mulholland. But Scribner, The Secret She Keeps, has been published by Scribner. I put down to Scribner in a sense because Scribner sort of were very keen to approach me. Stephen King has been wonderful to me in my career. I don't know the man. I've never met him, but he said some wonderful things about books of mine in the past, and he's obviously a huge figure in the Scribner publishing empire in terms of, you know, their most successful author, and I think there's a connection there with the reason that's why they wanted to publish me.
You know, I just talked to an author, and he wanted to use something from one of Stephen King's books, so he decided he was going to go to Maine and approach Stephen King at his house. This is a true story.
Wow.
And so he only got so far, and he couldn't get past whatever the security there. So what he ended up doing is he emailed him, and he got a response. And Stephen King said, "Yeah, sure, go ahead and use it." And they've now become email buddies. And I'm like, you got to be kidding! You know what I would give to have an email buddy like Stephen King?
Well, it's funny when he first it was a book called Shatter that I wrote. My fourth novel, and I was traveling in Europe with my family, and I started getting messages from people saying, "Oh, wow, you must be so thrilled," and I couldn't understand what they were talking about. And I finally get back and say, "Well, what's happened?" They said, "Well, Stephen King has just written an article, Entertainment Weekly or Entertainment News, and
right.
He called Shatter his best book of the summer." And I've gone, "Oh," I mean, I remember turning to my wife and saying, "Do you know, I said I could retire now and never sell another book, but I would sit on my rocking chair in my dotage and tell my grandchildren that Stephen King had just said that about me."
That's pretty incredible. And The Secrets She Keeps is new, and this is really riveting. I mean, it's like, it doesn't start out as riveting. It's a slow build. And was that intentional?
Yeah, I think it was the way the story was told. I mean, I try very hard to not write the same book twice, and this book falls into sort of probably more domestic noir territory, more so than what I've written before, more into that territory of sort of Girl on the Train or Gone Girl, with, you know, female narrators and obviously unreliable narrators as well. You're never quite sure who.
Hey, when you think about when you think about two women who are pregnant, you can think, "Oh, that could be really boring." Because all they do is talk about babies, you know.
Only a man could say that, David.
But I mean, I don't know. How much does a man like to hear about women and how they're feeling when they're pregnant, you know? And but it isn't.
But that takes into account. I mean, in fact, the truth of the matter is, and a lot of guys don't know that. I mean, I think this is a book for men and women. But I think this is. You know, the greatest readers of crime fiction in the world are women. Women read more fiction than men. They read more crime fiction than men.
You mean I should have been born a female?
Well, no. I'm just sort of saying that some people sometimes associate that crime fiction's got to be this big blokey book with, you know, a Jason Bourne or Jack Reacher guy who, you know, outruns, outfights, outshoots, outdeads.
No, I don't think that's true. I totally disagree with that statement. I think it's based on how good the book is and what the book's about. I mean, people get so upset when they. I mean, if Lee Child didn't publish Jack Reacher, you would have a whole uprising of people who would be extremely upset because they love Jack Reacher. And I understand that. But if Lee Child said, I want to try something different, try a totally different novel, I would love to see what he would do with it.
Absolutely. But then again, would you ask him if he wrote a book about two pregnant women? Would you say, do people really want to read about two pregnant women?
Well, but you made it so good. I mean, you've made this book, it's really tremendous. And I can't even tell people why it's tremendous. And people are going to have to read it just to figure out what I'm talking about. But it wasn't anything like I thought it was going to be. I thought, oh, God, I don't know if I want to read about pregnant women.
Going back to what you said, I mean, it is... I mean, I should sort of set it up a little bit without giving it away. I mean, it's the story of Agatha, who works in a supermarket, who packs sort of supermarket shelves and is, you know, has had a pretty terrible life. And all supermarket shelf stackers are pretty invisible figures, you know, which you don't sort of
exactly.
know. And she looks forward each day to the arrival in the supermarket of an elegantly chic woman called Meg, who seems to have the perfect life, has got a very successful husband, a beautiful house, two gorgeous children, and both of these women are pregnant. Both of their babies are due on the same day or in the same week, and their lives collide in this book in the most dramatic of ways. And it's interesting you talk about being a slow burn, because really in the first half of the book you're meeting them and you're discovering that both of them have enormous secrets, and as you know, their lives aren't as, you know, Megan's life isn't as perfect as Agatha imagines, and they're both carrying terrible secrets. And then halfway through the book, suddenly those secrets begin to unravel, and then the book takes off at this sort of.
Boy, do they really unravel? I mean, it's like, wow, I didn't see this coming at all. And then there's that scene in the cemetery, which just blew my mind. I mean, that absolutely blew me away. I mean, I can still picture that scene, and it just freaks me out every time I picture it.
Yeah, I mean, but it's interesting. I mean, there are ways. I think my first novel, The Suspect, was called A Slow Burn, and they're the sort of novels where you light a fuse, and people, they know something's been lit. The reader knows it's been lit, and they just keep following, and they just wonder how long the fuse is. They can see it getting closer and closer, and I like that sort of.
Is this dramatic, and
that rat-sending tension.
Right. Well, I'm curious though. When you thought up the plot of this book, did the whole thing unravel in your mind, or did as you were writing it, did you get ideas?
It's seated in a real life event, which I can't talk about because it gives too much of the plot away. But I guess I knew. I've had the idea for about 20 years, and the telling point in terms of me deciding that it could be a novel was when I realized it had to be told through two points of view. You couldn't just choose one person to tell a story through. You had to tell it through the eyes of two women, and that was the turning point. And then, but I never really knew how I was going to resolve it. I don't plot the books in advance. So, you know, I knew that there were certain major events that were going to happen, but I didn't know how I was going to resolve it. And the trick was going to be also was how I was going to make both of these women, you know, given that, you know, one of them or both of them are unreliable, how I could make them both, in terms of narrators, how I could make them both sympathetic. Because, you know, otherwise you were just going to absolutely adore one of these women and hate the other one. And and the story would lose its impact. But I had to find a way of making both of them sympathetic characters. So really, you didn't know who I suppose your heart was with through the story, or whether your heart was going to be with both of them.
Yeah, I think mine was more with Meg through a lot of the story.
I mean, I've met women whose heart was with Agatha. You know, and I'm surprised by that often, because I'm with you, I think, but I have met women who wanted Agatha to win, so to speak, you know.
But and then you think, right away, you think, well, maybe she's a lesbian, maybe she's attracted to this woman, maybe that's why she's looking forward to seeing her every day, she's attracted to her. And but, you know, you did get, I think all kinds of ideas go through your head, and you try to, in your mind, determine what's going to happen next, and I didn't see what came at all. I mean, it hit me like a ton of bricks, and it was like, wow, now we really got something interesting, you know,
and that's one of the reasons that I've been so careful, and I've been so, you know, I've been on top of reviews in terms of trying, begging people not to give too much, or even people that read it, give too much of the story away, because I want it to hit everyone like a ton of bricks. It's, you know, it comes in that, for that category, you know, there have been some great films with great twists, like The Usual Suspects or The Sixth Sense and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't, but if you know the twist before you go in there, the impact is completely lost. The impact is not as great.
For some reason, I'm thinking of a movie called Notes from a Scandal, which was out years ago. It was in Judi Dench, and it was a very powerful, powerful
Zoe
movie.
Yeah, right.
But those women meet, and you suddenly realize that Judi Dench is sort of attracted to Cate Blanchett, and then all of a sudden it just blows up, you know, it just blows up, and that you can't take your eyes off of what's happening. It's just like, oh my God, this is like unbelievable. How did this start from something so simple as a meeting, you know, saying hello to somebody, and then and it's amazing what they can do with a movie like that, with the actresses that they have, you know, and
absolutely. It was a fine book before it was made into a fine movie. As well.
And then you finally find other things out, and it's like, whoa! And then it's like, you know, you don't know where the movie's going next. It's so powerful, and then you suddenly realize, wow, I could watch that movie again. You know, that's the great thing about movies, when you watch something that is so powerful that you can do it again. Now, reading The Secret She Keeps the second time would be a little difficult, because you know something in advance, but there's nothing that replaces that first shock of what you find out.
No.
But so you write,
and you read a book like The Secret She Keeps again, sometimes just to, you'd read it again to actually work at, it's almost like the construction is so delicate to make the two stories weave together, you'd read it again and just go, if you're interested in writing in particular, how did he do that? How did he manage to tell both those stories and keep all that sort of hidden from me?
Well, that's your talent.
Right, the emotional impact wouldn't be as great. It wouldn't be the punch in the stomach that you get the first time.
Right, exactly. Do you think you're really, really talented? I mean, how do you view your writing?
You can't ask someone like that. Question like that. Oh, do I think I'm really talented? Look, I think...
Is that embarrassing to ask you that?
Yeah, a little bit. No, but I think I suffer, well, I know I suffer from something called imposter syndrome. Every time I deliver a book, I'm convinced this is going to be the book that exposes me as a complete fraud who doesn't know what I'm doing. And I actually sign each book to my long-time agent. I sign a copy and say, you know, dear Mark, we fooled them again. Because every time, like, I'm writing a new book now, and in my heart I'm thinking, this is rubbish, this is terrible, this is going to be the one that's going to actually expose me as a fraud. And each time I've managed, you know, this is sort of just my mindset. It's almost what drives me on, is this fear of failure rather than desire to succeed.
Well,
it's a weird motivation.
It's interesting, because sometimes you read a book, and I'm reading one now, and it's about a guy who, he's caught on camera in a convenience store, and you obviously know he's guilty, and or you, but you think to yourself, there has to be more. I'm only on page 100, and there's 350 pages. There's more to this story than I think there is. So you know there's more to it. So that's a little bit disappointing. It's the books that really make you, that you don't see that where something's coming. You don't see, well, it must be that. You can't figure it out. Well, maybe he's got to be innocent, or why would they have him arrested on page 100 when there's 250 pages left? Do you see what I'm saying? You have to be able to drop that bomb and make it effective, and make it something that somebody didn't see coming.
Well, it's a case of I liken it to when you're writing, and it often comes in the rewrites of the way you plant your landmines. As a writer, what you're trying to do at times is you're trying to distract the reader, not totally. The reader can almost see you planting a clue because you've got to plant it well enough where they, you know, that they do remember that you've planted it, but they don't realize the significance of it. And so it's not till much later in the book when they step on that landmine and it sort of blows up that they go,
And it's weird because
I saw him do that.
Right.
I saw him do that. Why didn't I remember, you know?
And I mean, today there's so many books where people have secrets. That seems to be an ongoing theme for a lot of books. Now, they have secrets. And, you know, and some of the secrets are so standard. He's got a mistress, or he was seeing somebody on the side, and that's so. But that, and you can't be surprised by something like that. But it's how good is the author at surprising the reader, as far as taking them on a journey and shocking them in different ways. And that's not easy to do.
I think that's my, I mean, I agree with you about, I think one of the issues we have and the difficulties we have as writers now is that, okay, I mean, and you're an example of that. I mean, readers are so sophisticated in terms of not just the sheer number of books they've read, but the number of TV shows and films they've seen. It's very hard to create a twist that readers don't see coming because they have seen so... I mean, it's almost like they've seen all the tricks of the trade. And to actually... To fool them or to surprise them, you have to do... You either have to be clever at planting the clues, or... the other thing, I think, is sometimes you have to make your characters so compelling that and create not just the one twist, obviously. You've got to create a couple of hidden ones without going to ridiculous... I mean, I always hate those books or movies where it has one twist too many, where you suddenly sort of jump the shark, mm-hmm. you know, where people believed you up until then, but suddenly this twist, you know, where the reader goes, oh, no, come on.
And you know who does that? You know who does that? And sometimes it's good. Jeffrey Deaver is very good at doing that, at throwing these. I mean, at the end of his book, sometimes they'll have two or three twists. And after a while, you know, you have to be careful with the twists, because after a while, people won't believe them anymore. Or they'll think it's too coincidental.
Yeah, this is, and one of the great pieces of advice, you know, you give to writers, you don't write with God on your lap, in terms of, you know, you don't have outrageous coincidences, you know, that your whole plot, you know, swings upon and relies upon. And I agree with you. I think there are writers at times that think that they need one more twist, and it does, and it's so ridiculously coincidental that it destroys what they've done before, you know, and it certainly dissipates what they've done before.
And then with you, I mean, I've had both of these books, this one and Say You're Sorry, which are, in my mind, the two best you've ever written. But I haven't read every one of your books, so I can't really judge every one. But those are the two that have impacted me the most, that have entertained me to the point where I've been able to get through sicknesses and all kinds of sleepless nights. And those two books helped me do that. So that's a credit to you, because you kept me page turning. You kept me wanting to know what's going to happen. And that's what the author wants. The author wants you to be invested in their novel. Because if you open the book up and 40 pages in, you don't care, there's a problem.
Oh, no, I agree. You know, if I had a three-word motto, and I don't like three-word slogans or mottos, but if I had one above my desk, it would be "Make them care." Because I firmly believe that you have to create characters that readers really care about. Now, it might not be necessarily that readers like them or love them, but they really care about them enough and sort of want to know what happens. And that the reader is invested then. The reader will stay with you because they're desperate to know what happens to these people.
And they trust you. And they trust you. I mean, there are writers out there, I don't trust James Patterson, and I will never trust James Patterson because he's let me down any number of times. There have been so many books, I'd say more than a couple of his books where the ending was so bad I wanted to scream and throw the book across the room. And I don't like that. When an author does that to me, I feel cheated. I feel like I don't want to ever read that author again. That's scary. That could ruin your whole career.
This is one of my frustrations with the way publishing works. So not so much publishing, but human nature is that that so often what will happen is readers, even if the last four or five books of a particular writer they used to love, but have suddenly started mailing it in, you know, and just even if the last four or five books have been utterly disappointing, and you know, as you say, you want to throw them across the room, when they walk into a bookstore, that reader, and they're faced with the prospect of buying, you know, the new James Patterson or the new, you know, someone they've heard of that disappointed them, and a writer they haven't heard of, they will always go for the writer that they've heard of, even if it's a writer that's disappointed them in the past. And it's frustrating. It's why it's hard for new, really good new young writers in this business to actually get a foothold in and toehold and try to make a career.
What's frustrating to me is that I've read some of James Patterson's that were really, really that good, some of the early ones. And to me, in my mind, he doesn't do that much anymore. And that's disappointing to me. I don't like that. I want to write to him and say, go back to the way you were writing because it was good before, but it sucks now. You know, and I'm not trying to pick on him singly. I mean, I guess I am really, but
no. I mean, I don't like picking on writers anyway. But I mean, another person. You know, I think the early Patricia Cornwell books, the Case Scarpetta books,
yes,
were groundbreakingly brilliant. I mean, just astonishing.
Absolutely.
Post-mortem and those early ones. And then there's an example of a brilliant writer who should have pensioned off a character and started a new series because the Case Scarpetta books just don't match. The ones now don't go anywhere near to matching the ones at the beginning.
You know? And then you had she tried to write that Southern Cross series, and that didn't work at all. I mean, it was just like a comedy set in I guess it was the South or Virginia.
I didn't read that one. Yeah.
And they were just so different and so shockingly dull compared to what she had written before that the reader feels shortchanged. The reader feels like they're wasting their money. It's like, I mean, I still read the Scarpetta series. I've read every one. I still like them, but I in my hard know that they aren't like they used to be. They're very different in tone. It's like her career changed her books. I don't know. I mean, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, it's hard though, isn't it? Because you know, I've just written a standalone in The Secret She Keeps. You know, whereas my long time sort of series protagonist was a psychologist called Joe O'Loughlin, who's been in eight of the books, including Say You're Sorry, which you mentioned. But I desperately try not to write the same book again and again and again. And readers are quite funny. It's funny, when I've written my two latest standalones, one was Life or Death, and set in Texas, and then there was this one, The Secret She Keeps. And the first reaction you get when you tell readers, when you do an event, oh, by the way, this isn't part of the series, you get this collective sigh because people love series. And then, of course, once they read the book, the standalones tend to be even more successful for me than my series does.
So you're in this
sort of, in a sense, they like the familiarity of a series. They like being able to put on a pair of slippers and sitting in your favorite armchair and picking up a book and being with friends again. But they're also really quick readers when you ask them, what was that book like? And they'll go, oh, look, it was great, but a bit like the last one. They're a bit samey. And sometimes that's a good thing for people. Other times I get bored with reading a book that's just too similar to the one I've read before.
And you're sort of in the same shoes as Harlan Coben, because Harlan Coben was writing series and series, and people loved Myron Bowler, so they couldn't get enough. And then he suddenly did standalones, and they just sold magnificently, and he was able to branch off and do them one after the other. It's amazing his readers let him do that. I mean, he could have very easily have ruined his career.
Yeah, I know, because when you tell a publisher, I remember before I wrote Life or Death, that's the book written about the guy who escapes from prison the day before he's due to be released.
Oh, right, yes, yes.
The first one I said in Texas. When I told my publishers I was going to write a book, go away and write a standalone, I was going to set it in Texas, they get this sort of fixed smile on their faces, and they nod, and you can see that behind their eyes they're going, God, how much money is this going to cost us? Readers are going to abandon us.
They can see all the money flying away in the wind, There it all goes. He's ruining everything. He's trying to ruin the publishing company.
Ruining his career. Yeah, that's right. But then, of course, when the book succeeds, you can bring new readers to yourself. You prove that your readers will come with you, a bit like Harlan did, that they're loyal and they'll come with you. And then the other time is you attract new readers, because there are some readers out there that look at someone like, Michael Connelly, for argument's sake, and think they would love to read Michael Connelly, but the thought that they also, the sort of reason, saying, but I want to read from the start.
Right.
But the thought of going back and reading 25 books is so, 25 Harry Bosch books is so, mountainous, that sort of pile, they sort of think, they love the idea that they can pick up a standalone, because it seems too big a chore. It's like starting to watch a TV series, and when you haven't watched a single episode, and there's been seven series, and you think, "Oh, life's too short. I'm never going to get through this."
Right. Exactly. I'm thinking of Kate Atkinson. She wrote a book, and I can't remember the name of the book. Oh, Case Histories. One of the most unusual.
Gosh, wonderful book.
As I recall, it's told from like three different viewpoints, there's three different cases, I think, is what it is. They'd run through the book.
Maybe there's four, yeah.
Is it four?
Yeah, I think it's four.
Is it four? That book was amazing. I mean, it was just, and she did it so beautifully. Now, I haven't read anything by her lately, and I'm not saying she doesn't know what she's doing anymore. I don't know. I mean, her books have been, I think the last one was like 1,000 pages, a long, long book, so I'm not sure if she still has what she had before, but...
I think she, Life After Life, which is one of the more recent ones, which was up for the Booker Prize. I mean, she's a beautiful, beautiful writer. And, I like her Jackson Brodie sort of police. She's done sort of wonderful sort of little series with a character called Jackson Brodie. I love those books. The Life After Life, the one that she's done, the last couple that she's done, actually, they are big bricks of books. And they are very different. They're more historical sort of, not even mysteries. They're set in they're time shift sort of World War II time shift novels of parallel lives and what would have happened if certain things, if certain events had changed, how would history have changed? They're that sort of territory.
Yeah, I don't like them as much. I don't know why. I don't find them as appealing. But that's just me. I mean, I think a lot of people do, but I think she might be a case of people miss her series more than anything. I can't imagine they don't. But your book, Life or Death, got a lot of attention. It's still, I mean, I remember reading a lot about it when it came out, and it was very well lauded.
It was shortlisted for the Edgar for best novel in the U.S., and it won the Gold Agger in the U.K. Against Stephen King and J.K. Rowling, were both on the shortlist that year. That was in 2015. And so, that was probably my most celebrated book. And it was a standalone that I chose to set, because all the other books had been set in the UK. And then I decided to set the book in Texas, in that sort of area, which is now sadly underwater after the floods. But I think that was an enormous challenge for me to not just...
Well, when you turned it...
It's sometimes easier to write a book. If you're going to set it in another country, to do a fish out of water sort of story, to take in sort of small town America.
But when you...
write a book set...
I'm sorry.
Set sat there with all the characters are Texan, is far more difficult.
I was going to say, and I always do this to authors. I always butt in when they're in the middle of a sentence because I think of something and I know that's going to leave my head if I don't ask it. I was going to say, when you handed in Life or Death, your publishers must have been very happy when you handed it in.
Yeah, no, they could see that. They were actually we got tremendous sort of early reaction from publishers because it had a real the book's got a real Shawshank Redemption vibe to it, and they could see, you know, film and all sorts of other possibilities for it, and it had a huge heart to it. And so, no, my American publishers were absolutely over the moon. I mean, I think they would love to see me write more books set in America. Honestly, I mean, writers are not supposed to say they've got favourite books because books are supposed to be like your children. You don't have favourites. Although all parents know they do have favourites. It just varies on the day. The reason what I'll say about Life or Death, every writer has this bright, shiny book in their head. They might have an idea and they have this vision of putting this idea perfectly on the page. And what happens is the book they finally write is never quite as perfect as the one they imagined. And Life or Death is the book that I've come closest to getting the vision that I had in my head onto the page. I'm not saying it's perfect, but it's the closest I've ever come to capturing exactly what I had in my head.
Well, when I
and which is why I'm really proud of it.
Well, exactly. When I read over New Year's Eve, I was feeling very, very sick to my stomach. I was having a horrible time, and I picked up your Say You're Sorry book. That book got me through that weekend, and, you know, I will always be grateful for that. There was something about that book, and after I read that book, I knew I was going to read you from then on. That book, in my mind, is so incredible in so many ways. There's just something about it, and I decided after that, well, I'm definitely going to read this author. I mean, this will definitely not be the last time I read it. And that's a wonderful thing when a reader finds... I'm sorry?
Yeah. Oh, it's great. When you find a writer, it's like when you recommend a writer to someone, a friend, and they come back to you and go, wow, that was amazing. What else can you recommend? Because that absolutely great, warm feeling, you know, when you discover a writer or you recommend someone that someone loves.
And recently I read one called The Magpie Murders, and now I'm hooked on that writer, and he has another book out right now in the UK, which is not available in the United States, apparently. The word is murder, and I want to read it. It's about a woman who plans for her funeral, and 6 days later she dies. And it's a great premise. I mean, I don't know what she does with the book, because I haven't read it yet. Not she. I don't know why I said she. Anthony Horowitz is the writer. I have no idea why I said she.
No, he's wonderful.
But what a great premise. I mean, when you think of that great premise and then go from there and think up. And that's the beautiful thing about having ideas, because sometimes you have a really great idea and then you think to yourself, can I really pull this off? Can I really write a book and make it plausible and make it real enough that people are going to believe it and love it? And do you say that in your mind a lot?
Yeah, well, I mean, all my books are seated in events. So, for example, Life or Death, as you know, the date, March the 20th in 1995, I read a two-paragraph newspaper article about a two-times convicted killer who escaped from prison the day before he was due to be released. And I carried that paragraph with me for 15, 16 years, thinking, first of all, asking myself the question, why would someone do that? Yeah, and then it took me a long while. I knew I came up with a reason why someone might do it, and then it took me a lot of years before I thought I had the skill enough to tell the story. And so that's they're the sort of seeds, you know. Then that became Life or Death. You know, it opens with a guy escaping from prison the day before he's due to be released, and that was the hook that they put on it. You know, the front cover is why would you know. You know, due to be released tomorrow, why escape today is the tagline, you know, which is a great little hook. It's what draws readers in.
Well, you think about the big writers today, writers like John Grisham, and you think, John Grisham could write about anything and people would read it. He does have that status where no matter what he writes, people are going to read it. But you think, as a writer, don't you want every book to be really as good as you can possibly get. You don't want to phone in a plot. You don't want to phone in a book and not really give it all you've got. I mean, do writers do that? I mean,
I certainly try to make each book as good. I mean, you've got to accept at times. I mean, the difference between literary writers and genre writers is that a literary writer, their entire career can sort of revolve around one book. I mean, they can write a lot of books, but one book, if it's a sort of book that changes lives and wins all the big awards, wins a Pulitzer or whatever, that's their career. Whereas the genre writer is only as good as his or her last book. And I don't think I certainly don't. I try desperately to make each book better than the last one. But I'm also a realist in knowing that sometimes ideas aren't as strong, or sometimes, you know, because I don't plot my books in advance, I mean, as I said, I have imposter syndrome. I'm convinced that each book is going to expose me. I would love to be able to say that I'm sure every book I write is going to be better than the last one, but I'm also realistic enough to know that actually, you know, that's not likely to happen. When I wrote Life or Death, I didn't think it was possible for me to write a better book than that. You know what I mean? But mm-hmm. I've written two since then.
Do you think you learned something? Do you think you learned something with each book, and that's why they get better?
I actually think, sadly, that every time you finish your book, you forget how to write. And when you start again, you feel as though you haven't written anything.
Really?
And, yeah.
Do you think Nora Roberts feels like that?
I don't know. I certainly feel like that. I feel as though, I mean, I'm sure Lee Child doesn't, because, you know, he starts work on September the 1st every year, starts work on a new book. Maybe they've got the formula in their head or whatever now. It's also because, you know, particularly with a book like The Secret She Keeps, you know, because that was so different, you know, two female protagonists to capture two first-person voices, you know, to research, you know, pregnancy and infertility and all those issues that I had to look at. And I had to read months of reading mummy blogs and doing that research. I mean, all of that, it's such a different book. You know, maybe if you're writing the same character in a series over, you know, like a Jack Reacher book, it's not that difficult because you know what Reacher would do in any given situation. But when you're creating standalones and new characters, you have to investigate and explore them fully and build them from the ground up.
It's amazing how neurotic you are. I had no idea you were this neurotic. Do you think all writers are like that? To a certain extent?
Actually, I'm not going to speak for all, but I have never met a writer who doesn't, at some point during the, and you know, Stephen King included in this, at some point during the writing of a novel, completely loses faith in the idea, can't remember why they thought it was a clever idea, thinks it's an awful, awful book. They're not laughing at the one-liners anymore. The plot twists are clever anymore. And writing the last third of a book is an absolute chore because you're trying to just desperately finish this project that you think is awful, and then you polish and polish and polish, and you think at the time you're polishing a turd because you know you've fallen out of love with it. And then at some point in all of that, you actually look back and you read it again, and you think actually, that's not bad.
Exactly. You've met J.K. Rowling, so you've met some of the... I mean, what is she like?
Oh, that was very funny, actually, because when I won the Gold Dagger in the UK, it was a big award ceremony, I had no idea that she was in the audience. You know, I knew she'd been shortlisted, but, you know, I knew Stephen King hadn't made the journey from Maine to London. I think all the other shortlistees were there, but I thought that there's no way J.K. Rowling would be there. Anyway, I won the award and I made my sort of acceptance speech. And as I came off, I was sort of, you know, loads of people, journalists and other people wanted to congratulate me or interview me. And someone grabbed me by the sleeve and said, "Joe wants to meet you." And I said, "Okay, in a second." And they're dragging me through this crowd, and they're saying, no, 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 now, Joe wants to meet you. And finally, I turned around to this person, and I won't swear on radio, but I, on online, I said, who the F is Joe? Just as the crowd parted, and there was J.K. Rowling.
And she heard you say that?
I did, and I had no idea what, and I said, I am so sorry, because she heard me. I said, I am so sorry, I had no idea. And she laughed, and she was so, so sweet, and she actually tweeted, we had a long chat, and then, because I told the story about my, when I was on stage accepting award, about my mother and my mother's reactions to my books, and she said that her mother was exactly the same. And then she tweeted, and she got about 4 million Twitter followers. And so she tweeted congratulations to me, and I don't think I've ever had more retweets or more responses to anything that's ever been online.
Do you think you can handle that many people following you, 4 million people, hanging on your every book?
No, not at all. And also, she's so incredibly political, and, you know, she's sort of... just Donald Trump's nightmare. She's forever sort of tweeting political stuff. I mean, I avoid sort of, you know, putting anything online that's overtly sort of political, because you know that you're going to upset half your readers, you know, when you do that. And but J.K. Rowling, she just, if she doesn't believe, you know, something, or if she, you know, she's passionate about something, she'll just wade in there. And she's a huge Twitter star.
Now, had you when you met her, had you read all of her books?
I'd read all of her Harry Potter books to the kids.
How about the Cormorant Strike
book? I was sent the first Robert Galbraith book in proof copy, asking if I would blurb it, and I, you know, whether I'd, you know, I'd put a quote on the front of it. And a whole lot of other writers I know were sent copies as well, and I didn't get a chance to get around to reading it because, you know, I just get offered too many requests like that, and I'm too busy. And of course, when it broke, it came out and was very, you know, it was actually really well received. And then it broke who Robert Galbraith was. I remember thinking to myself, oh wow, I wish I'd read it before. And I went back and read it. Of course, I was very impressed with Picky's first time crime writer. I think she did a remarkable job. Yeah, and actually, I just noticed on last night that the BBC TV series based on those her crime novels, the Galbraith novels, has just been released in the UK.
So. Oh, really? I heard it was coming, but I didn't know when.
Yeah.
So once again, without really realizing it, you offended her. That's two times you've done that.
I didn't mean to. A lot of writers. Look, I should have known as well, because when I look back and saw who edited the book and who sent the book, it was my editor, it was my publisher. So we share an editor and a publisher. And so when I look back, I sort of thought, I should have known.
Now, when your editor sent it to you, had he already read it? He or she already read it?
Yeah, absolutely. They knew. There are only three people in the world in the publishing house who knew that Robert Galbraith was J.K. Rowling. And one was the editor, one was the publisher, and one was the head of accounts that drew the contract up. So the person that sent it to me knew that it was J.K. Rowling. But they didn't tell me, obviously, because it was a you know, secret. But I looked at the other writers that she sent. The editor also sent a book to Val McDermid and a book to. I mean, and we're all in the same little stable of writers, and it made sense in the end. But honestly, and I knew actually, because I knew that we were publishing J.K. Rowling's novel under her own name, A Casual Vacancy.
Right.
But no idea that she was going to write a crime series. So the fact that, you know, it was the editor that also edited A Casual Vacancy. I mean, there are little clues there that I only realized were clues later.
Exactly. And speaking of Al McDermott, her book, A Place of Execution, I think is a masterpiece. That is...
My favorite one of hers. She's a huge friend of mine. She's a great mate of mine. And that book is, without doubt, my favorite Val McDermott book.
There's something about that book, and the powerhouse way that book ends. I mean, you never see that coming, and the way she did it was just blew me away. I mean, it remains my favorite of hers. And people mention, you know, what book should I read? And I mean, she's good. She's really can get quite gory. You don't get really gory with your books. You're not really a gory writer.
No.
Is that intentional?
Avoid that. Yeah, very much so. I love, you know, it's not that I won't read sort of books that if they're well written. I mean, you take a book like Silence of the Lambs is one of the most beautifully written books, you know, but also quite a gory book. If the violence is necessary, I'll put it in there, but I won't put sort of torture scenes or I won't put the really gory stuff in there. I just don't, you know, to me, I'm interested in the psychology of why things have been done, not in the, you know, the gruesomeness of what's actually happening. And I think one of the clever things, well, I'm hoping it's a clever thing. I know you mentioned the book, Say You're Sorry, about the two teenage girls that go missing and the book is half narrated by one of the girls who's obviously been imprisoned for all these years that she's been missing. But there's a scene in that book which I had readers come up to me and claim was the most graphic and disgusting scene that they had read. And I said, I didn't write that scene. And they're going, yeah, it's in the book. I said, no, it's not. Go back and read it. And of course, it wasn't in the book. It was in their imagination. They had seen, I'd written about people reacting to something, but not the actual event. They reacted to it, and in the reader, but the reader, obviously I'd done it well enough that the reader had actually pictured the whole thing in their head and thought that I had described it. I like that idea off camera. Do it off camera.
I like that you remember that, because a lot of times when I interview authors, they're on to like two or three books ahead. And when I interview them for their book, sometimes they can't remember what was in the book because they're on to like the book after the book, even the book after that sometimes. And it's frustrating.
That happens to me. I think that, but that scene, the one, I just often get approached by readers with that scene, and I always, to me, it's just an example of the power of words, that you don't have to graphically describe a rape, for example, or something like that. Often you can look at the aftermath and people's reactions to it, and in the reader's mind, they will have experienced it, you know, just as emotionally, you know, and without and you haven't had to describe it.
It's like the series Hannibal they made. That series was so graphic. After a while, I couldn't even deal with it anymore. I couldn't deal with how graphic it was. And you know, it there's just, to me, there's sensory overload. It's like, all right, I get the picture, but now the scene goes on and on and on, and it just gets worse and worse. And you're like, well, how much do you need to see? How much do you need to see blood and gore and all this stuff before it really disturbs you enough that you can't get it out of your head?
And I did know that Joe, I was having a conversation with Joe Nesbo, the wonderful, you know, Scandinavian writer, and he said that one of his most recent books, he thought he was, because his books are quite graphic, he was going to just see how far he could push the envelope, and he put a torture scene in there which is so horrendous that he got tremendous criticism from reviewers and readers, and he admitted afterwards that it was almost an experiment to see what people would accept, and he admitted he went too far. I don't even want to experiment, you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, there are books, I don't want to write a book. I mean, I've read books, and even though they might be books I've enjoyed, that I've basically held with two fingers while I've carried them to the bin. And it's not that I haven't enjoyed it, it's just that I bin them because I do not want my wife and children to read them because they are so graphic in their violence.
So when you said you've written how many Joe books? There's eight of them now?
I think there's eight, yeah.
And are you working on nine?
Yeah, I'm working on Joe, almost finished a Joe book, hoping to deliver it in the next week or so, Joe Lockwood, which may well be the last one for a while. Because I introduce in The Secret She Keeps, a new one, I've actually introduced a new psychologist called Cyrus Haven, who quite intrigued me, had a very interesting backstory. He's the sole survivor of a of a family massacre, and the reason he became a psychologist was because obviously as a child he'd survived this terrible crime. And I'm interested in maybe doing a book with him.
Right. So
as the main character.
So this will be a new series, you think?
Maybe, yeah. It was actually my American publishers suggested it, because they actually loved the Cyrus Haven character. And also, the issue with Joe O'Loughlin, you know, he's been now around, I've aged him in real time, and, you know, I guess Joe has got this brilliant mind, but a crumbling body. He diagnosed Parkinson's in the very first novel, so he's got this,
wow,
you know, this Holmesian ability to sort of read human behavior and read clues, but, you know, his body is failing him, and so there's a use-by date to Joe, and so I think the one I'm writing now will be the last for a little while anyway, and I'm going to perhaps start a new series and with Cyrus Haven, and see how it goes. And I think I will come back to Joe at one point, at some point, or maybe do a bit like Michael Connelly has done with his Mickey Haller,
right,
and Harry Bosch, you know. Had the two series sort of, you know, combine. So maybe that's possible as well.
I like Harry Bosch, and I like the new girl, but I don't really care if I see Mickey Haller anymore. I don't know. Mickey doesn't stay with me, not as much as Harry. And
funny, well, I'm the opposite. Actually, I loved the most recent one I read is the Mickey Haller with Gods of Guilt, and I thought that was such a wonderful book.
Mm-hmm.
And I quite like that new series. I haven't read the new one, the new Renee, I can't think of the
Renee
name.
Ballard, yeah.
Protagonist.
I like her.
Yeah.
I like where that's going.
I've got a copy of that next to my bed. It was sent to me, and I'm looking forward to reading it, because I had a long chat to Michael, and he actually has done something a bit different. I had a long chat to Michael when he was at the Sydney Writers' Festival a couple of years ago, and we were chatting about Harry Bosch and where to now, and he was toying with the idea then of maybe going back and writing a couple of novels with Harry in, because Harry was a tunnel rat in Vietnam during the war.
Right, yes.
And going back writing sort of stuff about Harry in Vietnam. And it was interesting. But he didn't, at that point, unless he just didn't tell me, he didn't mention that he was going to sort of start a new series with a female protagonist.
I've heard
great things.
Yeah. I was going to say, you get to meet a lot of crime writers. I wonder, have you ever met one where you didn't really like their books and were had any awkward situations where, I mean, what do you do if you meet a crime writer and you don't really like their books? What do you do in a case like that? You just say...
You know what happens all the time? What happens all the time is you can often meet people you really like. And they might be a new crime writer, and you do want to support the next generation,
mm-hmm,
or whatever. And then they send you their book, hoping you might sort of blurb or give them a bit of a leg up. And you read the book, and you actually think, this is not very good.
Right.
And you don't want to put your name on a book or recommend it to your readers when you don't actually think it's very good. Because, I mean, your readers get upset. I mean, I get upset by that when I pick up a book where someone I admire has blurbed it and,
uh-huh,
told me I should read it. That's what I admire about Stephen King. Actually, Stephen King does not talk about books unless he truly loves them. You know, there are some writers out there that are like Rent-A-Quote. They will blurb on everything, and you know, regardless of its quality. And I think and that's always hard, having to let people know. I mean, I always lie and say, look, I didn't get a chance to read it.
Do you really do that?
It's hard. Yeah, I just sort of said, look, I've been so busy. Well, because the truth of the matter is, and you know, every writer will tell you this, it's certainly if they've had a degree of success, the number of books we get sent, if we could spend our entire lives just reading other people's books that get sent to us,
right,
and we'd never get to write our own. You know, and so there's a limit to what you can do. So, and particularly if you also have your own favourite writers you want to read, you don't want to just read books that get sent to you. And so, I have met, it's funny, I think we're really, going back to the original question, we're a really collegiate bunch of crime writers. I think we're the cool group when we come to festivals. You know how often you're at a party and... it might be a pretty boring dinner party, but you notice the smokers are outside are all laughing uproariously and
right,
have a good time. And and you sort of think to yourself, God, I wish I smoked, because they're having much more fun out there.
Right.
Well, the writers of the smoking group, the crime writers of the smoking group outside, and so most of them are not. I have met a few that I won't mention their names.
No.
A few that I haven't liked. But there are so few, and on the whole, I mean, Michael Connelly is such a gentleman. When I was in LA last, he took me on set for the filming of Bosch, and
you know, really?
Dinner together, and it was. And to Ian Rankin, I had dinner with Ian Rankin in Edinburgh in November, and then you know when I was in town, and he had dinner with me when he came into Sydney. You get to meet them around the traps, and in a sense, because you, as writers, you work on your own all the time. You know, you're alone. These are sort of like workmates. These are people in the world that understand exactly what you go through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you can discuss writing and publishing, and you can sort of discuss stuff with them as though they were workmates. You know, and so it's a treat when you get a chance to sit down with them.
Well, if they say to you, "Can you read my book and let me know really know what you think?" That puts you in a bind, because what if you don't like it? What if you really hate the book?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that you won't do. It's a bit like, I've never asked a writer to blurb my books. Now, my publishers might send books out, but I have never personally gone to a writer that I admire, or I've met, or I've become friends with, and put them on the spot by saying, hey, will you read this for me? Because I don't want to put them on the spot, you know. I don't want them to make them feel obliged that they have to, you know, because they might not like the book, you know.
Right.
Saying that, I've been lucky at times. Independently, friends of mine have, like, you know, people like Val McDermott. Before I'd ever met Val, she was sent a copy of my book and wrote this amazing sort of blurb for it. And this was well before I'd ever met her. And so when I did meet her, I walked straight up to her and sort of said, look, I just want to say thank you for your generosity. And she just, that was the day we met, and we've been friends ever since, you know. I would never personally put someone on the spot like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I can understand how a lot of new writers do approach and do, because if they can get an important writer or a successful writer to blurb their book, then they're going to find it easier to get readers or to get a publisher.
Right. So there will be more standalones for me. I mean, we haven't seen the last of your standalones.
No, I think there'll be definitely more standalones. If someone told me,
because that's what I want to see. That's what I would say. You have to write more standalones.
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view, you know, if someone told me I could only write the same character for the rest of my writing career, I'd want to shoot myself. You know, because as much as I love my characters, I love my standalones as well. And you know, writing from the point of view of a single character is like living in a two-man tent with your best friend for an entire year.
Right.
And it doesn't matter how good a friend they are, eventually you want to break from them. And so I love my standalone. So there will be more.
Yeah, I would say I'd be very disappointed if I didn't see any more standalones, because I love opening up one of your books and not knowing any characters in it. I love that feeling of escaping into a whole new world. It's what it is. It's like that. Is that the Aladdin song, A Whole New World? You know, you have this whole new world that you're experiencing, and that is something that I would look forward to from you for a long time, and I can't imagine not having that at some point. You know?
Well, thank you.
Well, we have to let you go. It's been an hour now. It's hard to believe. We start to. This is the better interview of the ones we did that we did before. So I'm glad we waited and did the whole thing all over again. But you're just. I mean, I just love your stories. And I'm. The book again is called The Secrets She Keeps, from Michael Robotham. Am I saying your name right, Robotham?
That's close enough. It's Robotham or Robotham.
Robotham. Yeah.
It's a bit like what people call Gillian Flynn, but they call her Gillian Flynn. And you, no, she's Gillian Flynn.
you're never quite sure how it's really pronounced.
Actually, and I find in America in particular that, like, because my surname's a Yorkshire or an English name, and in America that's where people probably struggle most to pronounce it properly.
So do you have any kind of an idea what the next standalone will be about? Is there any germ of an idea in your head yet?
No, not for the standalones. The new Joe O'Loughlin book is going to be It's going to be called The Other Wife.
Oh.
And it's going to be, I can't tell you too much about that, but that's the working title. I'm hoping that's the
Well, I was just curious whether you had any kind of an idea for another standalone. Not that I would expect you to tell me.
I don't have a drawer full of ideas that I sort of reach into. I'm a one idea at a time person, and so, you know, I have little snippets of newspaper and stuff like that, but that's about all.
Is it possible that you'll be?
I can't give you any heads up. Also, it's too far away now, and I don't want to give my ideas away.
But is it possible that you'll be walking down the street, or maybe you're shopping in the mall, or shopping in? I don't know if you have Walmart over there, but is it possible that you'll be walking in a store and an idea will come to you?
Yeah. It's normally that, or it's something I read in the newspaper, or it's something I see online. Yeah, it comes from nowhere. And then I'll just stew on it for a few months and see what happens.
Well, I can't wait to see what's next. This has been a delight. Thank you for this length of time.
Thanks very much, David.
Thank you. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.